Welcome to Digging the Dharma, where we dig into the Buddhist Dharma and explore ways to bring these 2,500-year-old teachings into our lives. I'm Doug Smith of Doug's Dharma on YouTube and the online Dharma Institute.
And I'm John Aaron, teacher at New York Insight Meditation Center and mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher and teacher trainer and founder of Space to Meditate. Hello, Doug. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, John? Great to see you.
I'm okay. It's been a whole week, but here we are again.
Yes.
In front of our microphones, ready to launch into another Dig in the Dharma podcast.
Yep. Raring to go.
Yeah. maybe coming back to some basics. We sort of, on our last week podcast, we kind of went through the first three noble truths, first three ennobling truths. And of course, the fourth truth is another list, another bunch of numbers, the Eightfold Noble Path or the Noble Eightfold Path or
Eightfold Path for the Noble Ones or however you want to understand it.
Yep. Exactly. So, which is the Buddha's prescription for how to achieve the third noble truth more often, one should say, how to achieve awakening. And and the first two factors of the Eightfold Path are right view and right intention. And of course, what so often happens, I mean, I think because of the way modern mindfulness has sort of come into the fold, are many people just go right to the later factors of meditation.
Yeah.
And mindfulness, all of which is important and great. But it's also useful to have some sense of the wisdom factors before going there. What is there off in the distance that might be possible, I guess.
Right. And to an extent, I mean, those two wisdom factors are at the beginning, at least in one way of understanding, because it's those that bring us to, listening to podcasts like this one, right? Or to deciding to go to a meditation retreat or do meditation for a few minutes a day. Is that because that initial view and that initial intention are so important?
Yeah, it's also the case that like somebody will take on a meditation practice through, say, Headspace or something. Mm-hmm. And, which doesn't really talk about the wisdom factors, at least right away, and then they'll be doing this for 10 minutes a day for a year or so, and they'll realize, well, wait a minute, there must be more to this. And then they come to a class and gain some sense of what it's all about, really.
And that's really important, because I think for myself, I can say that if I were to come to meditation without this kind of background, it would be nice for a while. You would feel like you were calming yourself down, but then there would be a kind of
And what else?
Or maybe I've done all I have to do here, and let's, put the Headspace app away and never open it again kind of thing. Without sort of deepening the path, you're liable to sort of just think it's something very simple and sort of get rid of it after a while.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, right view is really kind of an acceptance and realization and some trust in the first three noble truths, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a place to start, right?
A place to start, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, oh, so this possibility of being free from suffering is actually true. It can actually happen. And it takes some effort, but it's there. It's possible. And then the wise intention, right intention, or wise intention. I always think of right and wise. I mean, I know that word,
samma.
Right. Yeah, samma is really about balance, I think, isn't it? To right a ship as one possibility, but it's like,
I think it's correct. It has a sense of correct or right, appropriate. I guess there are many ways of understanding it or glossing it, or glossing it as different, in different ways.
Yeah.
But it is opposed to wrong, Mitcha. Right. So it's right versus wrong. I think a lot of contemporary teachers sort of want to get away from the more normative aspects of the teaching because they seem a little bit preachy.
True.
In the early context, they were kind of normative. I mean, the intention was normative, that, you know, this is the right way to do it, and there was a wrong way, and you should pay attention to the right way. But if that's too normative for you, put it aside and use something else.
Right. Well, what I like to sort of think about is, okay, so we come to the right view, we come to right intention, and then we, you know, continue to flow through the path, you know, about right action and right speech and right livelihood, and then right effort, right mindfulness, et cetera, right concentration. Mm-hmm. And after we've gotten there, we come back, and the right actually becomes more like wise. Mm. In other words, we bring more wisdom to the wisdom factors as we've gone through this and continue to go through it. So there's really no end.
Right, exactly. You can think of it, I mean, in fact, in one of my courses, I talk about it as a spiral. I'm not the first person to use that.
No, you're not.
that idea. There's a lot of people who do, but in any event, in the Eightfold Path, it is kind of, can be thought of as a kind of a spiral, in the sense that you enter right view and right intention at the low end, and it's just the view, perhaps, that, hey, there might be a way for me to calm down a bit.
Yeah.
And an intention to try to find some calm somewhere. And so you try out some meditation for a while without any further real idea of where it might lead, but just an idea of, you know, let's try to get some calm or reduce stress in our lives. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's the initial intention. Maybe that's the initial view. But then if you keep going with it, you know, then the wisdom deepens, or can, at least if you let it, it can deepen. And then the next time you come, in a sense, if you think of it sort of, sort of in this kind of formal sense, you know, the next time you come back to right view, it's a little deeper, you know?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's always there anyway, but it's like there. Oh, yeah. And of course, the view, the first right view of like, oh, maybe this will bring some calm into my life. That view is a result of maybe seeing others, you know, maybe reading something, maybe hearing something, you know. So the view arises from something, generally, right? And when it comes to the factor of intention, I think it has many different ways of viewing that. Even there's skillful intention and unskillful intention. To start out with, but there's also the intention to keep looking, in a sense, you know, to not just accept things as they are, but to really look more deeply, which of course is mindfulness
and investigation of states.
Investigation is part of that, and then, you know, as we bring that intention, and the interesting thing is, and you know, we bring it in, we. It's January, so we can still talk about, you know, resolutions. But I mean, this is more, you know, an ongoing intention. And it's not like something we have to, I mean, a resolution to me is like, oh, I'm going to take on something new and this is what it's going to be. I mean, intention is something that's always present, but we're not always paying attention. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not always paying attention to our intention. And the other aspect I think of intention is just in terms of, some people refer to it as right emotion or right thought. And emotion in this sense for me is like, okay, am I bringing kindness in, or is this more of a, yeah, I'll do this, but, you know, that kind of, you know, and also when we look at our own faults, you know, can we bring a kindly intention to investigating those faults? So, the wise intention factor is really there all the time as well. And, you know, when we get into the later factors of action, it's like, well, it's really interesting. So the first factor on action around non-harming, basically, you know, so there are some who would say, you know, if you're really a quote good Buddhist, you'll be vegetarian. Say, okay, you know, so I'll become a vegetarian. But if the intention we're bringing to that vegetarianism is like, well, I'll do this. I really don't like it. I'll replace that aspect of my like flesh eating or fish eating or whatever, with something that tastes just like that, right? That's a very different intention than, oh, yeah, actually, what is it like to, you know, basically reduce harm by not eating animal products or whatever. So there are various ways of approaching anything which are a result of the emotion and the heart that we're bringing to it, or the quality of heart that we're bringing to it. So I think this is part of wise intention as well, or right intention as well. It's like, what's the quality of heart that you are bringing to everything that you do, including your meditation?
Mm.
Yeah. And how aware are we of it moment to moment?
Mm-hmm.
And that's challenging.
Well, yeah. I mean, that sounds like also like mindfulness too, is to bring mindfulness to all of our intention. I mean, in other words, mindfulness is in the background here in order to be aware of the quality of our intention as well as our emotional response to the world. I mean, that's sort of like...
And even with mindfulness, though, it's like, okay, well, you know, is this mindfulness infused with compassion? Or is it mindfulness that's just paying attention? You know, without that. And it's like it's not such a fine line, actually. Some would say mindfulness without compassion is just attention.
Mm,
yeah. Mindfulness with compassion is something else altogether.
Sure. You know, and then there's also the comparing mind, the conceit that comes with a lot of these notions that are somewhat normative. You know, insofar as we're talking about right intention or right view or whatever it is, there's this tendency that we all have to say, you know, I'm doing it right and this person isn't. Or I'm, you know, is to think of it in terms of comparisons.
Right.
Of doing it better than somebody else. Or doing it worse than somebody else. Or thinking, I'm not living up to this other person. And all of those conceits are themselves forms of wrong view in a certain sense. And not helpful. Not helpful to us in the long run. I mean, there's ways of using them that are skillful, more skillful than less. I mean, you know, it can be a spur to us to give us a little more effort, you know, if we think we can be doing better. But in the longer run, that kind of conceit is not useful. And especially it's not useful if we're puffing ourselves up and thinking that other
right,
people, you
right.
know, that we're...
Yeah. You know, and then there's just the mindfulness of intention when it comes to continually checking in on whether whatever we're doing is causing us harm or causing another harm.
Yeah.
And, you know, at what point in our practice does that become, I don't want to say automatic, but just kind of just natural, that there's no, we don't have to think about it. We
right.
just have to know it. You know?
Right. And there's also the related problem, which is that we don't want to get ourselves into overthinking. I mean, the Buddha, one of the differences between the Buddha's approach and the approach in Jainism, for example, is that the Buddha left a larger scope for us to be doing things without intending to, in the sense that for the Jains, you know, if you're walking and step on some creature by accident, you're responsible for that. And so your intention isn't so much what matters. What matters is what you actually end up doing.
Mm.
You know, if we come to our intention and we come to the idea of harming others with this idea, with a kind of a totalistic idea, we're going to end up thinking there's nothing we can do. You know, that anything, because it's true that anything that we do will, you know, potentially be harmful to somebody somehow.
Right.
And I think sometimes when I come to Buddhist discussions, I get this feeling that there are people in the discussion who are coming at it that way, and it can be overwhelming because it's just there's no end to the kind of papancha, the kind of, you know, thought, this kind of massive thought coming into it that's saying, you know, I can't do this, I can't do that. If I do this, then it might harm this person. And I think the Buddha was a little bit more relaxed around these things and saying, look, I mean, there's a sense of intention where, you know, look, sometimes, you know, if we're doing our best, you know, and trying what we can try to do, and by accident we hurt somebody, I mean, it's, you know, we can regret the hurt and apologize for it, of course. But there's a sense in which we're not responsible for that. I mean, you know, if right. if we've done our best, you know, we can let it go. And, you know, it doesn't have to be so, you know, I don't want to, you know, sometimes it sort of ends up seeming very heavy. And I don't think, for the Buddha, I don't think it was intended to be heavy in that way.
Right. Though it's also, we have to be careful because it can also be used as an excuse.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah. So that's where the mindfulness comes in. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, it would be, you know, the absolutism of the Jain's practice would be, that'd be kind of hard to imagine actually living that way.
Well, and yeah, you end up being in Jainism, the ultimate goal is one of complete non-action, you know, yeah. because any action you take has karmic results
right.
that are negative, because any, you know, anything that you do that, you know, that harms somebody is bad karma for you. And anything that you do will harm somebody to some extent or something anyhow. And something, so, yeah, I mean, the end goal is just is complete quietism, to do nothing. And that was certainly not what the Buddha, I mean, that was not what the Buddha was after. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So we're bringing it, but I mean, when it comes to, you know, intention, it's like, okay. So part of it is just the intention to be to be mindful of intention.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, mm-hmm. Wow. And even that, I mean, that slows us down already, mm-hmm. which is important.
Yeah.
You know, because if we don't slow down, we don't see as much. And so there's the intention to slow down. There's the intention to like, oh, okay, let me take this in, this idea of non-harming, and including non-harming myself. That's a big one that people forget about. You know, it's like, because so often, especially in this country, I would say, well, in the West, you know, we're so driven, career-driven, or, you know, driven in whatever we're doing, and there's so many professions, particularly the helping professions, right? Where our intention is, of course, to do good in helping someone, but we get to the point where we're helping so much that we forget about ourselves.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're forced to do that, right? So, you know, nurses have 12-hour shifts, you know. Well, are they given enough time in between to sort of take stock and stop every once in a while?
Yeah.
I remember, you know, I don't know how many years ago, 12 years ago or so, 13 years ago, when I was, you know, just doing a training program, and I had a chaplaincy training program and was working one of the hospital units. Was then Beth Israel, I think it's now part of Mount Sinai. You know, once in a while, I would ask the nurses if they wanted to just sit and meditate, you know, and they would sort of tear themselves away for like 5 minutes, and we would just sit. And it was like, oh, I needed that, you know, I really needed that. And this happens all the time in these professions. And so we have to remember another aspect of mindfulness is that recollecting, you know, to take care of ourselves. And it's so easy to forget because we just get so wrapped up.
Yeah. Or we can get abused by people, you know, who abuse our goodwill and our kindness. And I think we have to be aware of the fact that sometimes kindness in general forces us to do things that are unkind to ourselves. And so therefore we have to step back and rethink the whole situation and maybe even leave it. You know, I mean, there are times in which the kindest thing we can do is to step back and not engage.
Yeah. And we don't always see that as an option.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's so interesting, right? We get in, and this is what's so cool about the Eightfold Path. Here we are, you know, starting to talk about intention and view, and yet you can't help but to get into the other factors of the path almost immediately.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's always coming back to that. And I mean, even Samadhi, right Samadhi, you know, is, you know, taking that time to find that place of peace and tranquility, you know, and concentration and unification. And, you know, as we're holding that, it can remind us how important it is to just be and let the mind find its balance, let the mind find its peace, which then allows us to come back and act more wholesomely. And so, yeah, it's just this kind of, I don't know whether we would call it a spiral or a circle, whatever it is. I mean, it's a continual flow of experience. And just, you know, remembering in terms of right mindfulness, you know, to check our intention, to check our intention in relation both to harmful and unharmful speech, but also to check our intentions in terms of, well, why are we meditating? Mm-hmm. You know, what's my intention in meditating? Which, you know, became, of course, as you know, a big thing in the secular mindfulness world when people were taking on meditation to become better soldiers or whatever. And I mean, there's a value in that, of course, you know, but it wasn't to make people better at harming others. It was to sort of, you know, that bringing those practices in to the military, I think, you know, and knowing a couple of people that do this, it's to make, you know, sure that people are clear on their intention, you know, when entering a situation. And we certainly see, this could lead into a whole other half hour discussion, but I was just, watching a tragedy on the news the other night from the Middle East, you know, where, you know, and it's hard to tell really what's going on, but there's so much tension there that the tension is completely obscuring the truth of, you know, in moment to moment. And so people are reacting, and actually not seeing what's there in front of them, you know? And so if, you know, we bring mindfulness and wise intention into the professions that really have a certain level of tension built in, you know, how would that shift things?
Mm. Well, it can help a situation like that just to break whatever negative spiral that they're in. I mean, we've been talking about the positive spiral of the Eightfold Path, but there, of course, are always these terrible negative spirals that you get into. Violence, creating more hatred, creating more violence.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I mean, I'm desperately unsure what to do in these kinds of situations because they are so difficult, but, you know, obviously one way into it, difficult though it may be to do, is just to break that with some, you know, some willingness to step back mindfully and get an idea of the bigger picture. I mean, whether the individuals involved can do that, I don't know, but at least if they could, that would be one way out of it, to try to break that spiral just for a moment, step outside of it, you know.
Unfortunately, in the situations that we're thinking about, I imagine whether it's the Middle East or Ukraine, you know, those that are creating the challenges don't live that way. You know, I mean, they're not, you know, they have their view and they're sticking to their view and they're not seeing beyond their view, you know, and I think that coming back to right view, it's, you know, one aspect of right view is to actually open up your view, right? To let go of the view that you might be holding, and then open up to, you know, the truths that are just part of life, and opening up to those truths in a wholesome way, in a way that actually provides the potential for our own liberation, basically. Yeah. So, you know, we have to kind of...
Well, it has to be, I think, an awareness that the final goal is not one of greed and ownership and you know, ruling the world, but rather something a little bit more wise than that. And the problem is that so many of these people involved in these situations don't have that kind of right view.
Yeah, and of course, it's nothing new.
Yeah. So. It's always been that way. Even in the Buddha's day, it was that way.
Oh, yeah. And sad, but true. And so we just keep practicing. And the more people that are impacted by this, the more that view is expanded. and shared. And so, you know, this is an important intention also, is to, you know, recognize that we're not just doing these practices for ourselves, right? That as we bring these practices into our lives, you know, if our intention is wholesome, if our intention is filled with compassion, then naturally we're going to have an impact on all those people around us, you know? And so that's the beauty of practice and the beauty of bringing these practices into our lives.
Yeah. And most, and I would say much or most of the time, our intentions are, as the Buddha would say, sort of neither dark nor bright, the sort of in between, you know, there's, you know, we do all kinds of things in our lives that we have multiple intentions behind. Why do we do what we do for a living? Well, I mean, you know, part of it is wanting to help people, and part of it is needing or wanting to make a salary or support a family or whatever it is. It's a life is complicated, and I think we have to be aware of that and be aware that we're trying to do, I mean, you know, we're trying to do the best we can and, you know, give ourselves a break, I think, but also be aware of the fact that you know, there's some elements we could work on and other elements that are perfectly fine.
Yeah. So keep on keeping on, as they say.
Keep on keeping on. Yeah, that's right.
And,
keep on keeping on.
Yeah. But as you keep on, you know, really, really, you know, clarify and be clear on your intention as much as you can.
Yeah.
And also be willing to give yourself a break when you need to.
Yeah. I mean, I think being willing to give yourself a break opens yourself up to be the awareness of your own failings without kicking yourself for them. I mean, we're not perfect. None of us here are enlightened, at least to my knowledge.
Right. None of us is perfect.
Yeah.
And, or it's funny. I was introduced to this poem, and I've known about this art. I was reminded of this art by somebody who was in a class. But you know, there's this Japanese art of I think it's
Kintsugi. Yeah, Kintsugi. Yeah.
Kintsugi, and you know, which is the art of filling cracks with gold or repairing things with gold. And, you know, how the art is like to actually break a pot and then put it back together in a way that shows its cracks and shows its imperfections. And I think it's such a beautiful metaphor.
Well, and yeah, I mean, the art of Kintsugi is sometimes that the piece is more beautiful after having been broken and repaired than it was to begin with, which
I mean, the real artist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing. It's a very long process, and it takes a lot of patience.
Sure.
And that's the other part of it. You know, it's like, so that quality of patience. Anyway, I'm not going to read the poem, but you can look it up. It's called Japanese Bowl.
You can leave a link to it if it's on the web.
And actually, one of the teachers in our team from Space to Meditate is taking a class in it.
Ah, great.
And she sent me a video of the man who's her teacher. On YouTube, actually, and the video itself is like a Dharma talk. It's really quite remarkable, so I'll leave a link to that too.
A lot of overlap between Japanese aesthetics and Buddhism.
Absolutely,
clearly a lot.
Yeah, and this is very much a Zen practice, I think. Mm-hmm. So great.
Yeah, and you can always put some coffee in that
you've
broken and repaired.
Now that you mention it, you know, I broke one of these mugs yesterday and I forgot all about that. I threw away the shattered pieces.
Oh, no.
Well, I don't have the gold around.
No.
And I didn't have the time. Oh, well.
Oh, well.
Speaking of which, for those of you that were listening last week, later this morning, an Asian artist is going to come in. A woman who's a specialist in Asian art is going to come in and help repair the screen that broke last week. So, not help. I mean, she's going to repair it.
But not Kintsugi.
Not Kintsugi, no. Not but Kintsugi. I don't think there'll be any gold used, just paint and glue, I guess. Anyway, okay, friends. And, we forgot about the coffee. Well, we did mention the coffee. Coffee. This cup is empty at the moment. It needs to get filled. And you can help fill that coffee by...
Please do.
Buying us a cup of coffee or two or three or four. And we thank those of you that have, and it supports us, keeps the show going, at least covers our costs. So go to digginthedharma.com, leave us some comments. talk to us about your intentions, how you're working with wise intention, right intention.
Yeah, and if you have any questions, feel free to leave them. We would love to hear your questions.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
See you, Doug.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on your podcast directory. And please check us out at diginthedharma.com, where you can leave a comment, buy us a coffee, and even become a member. You can find out more about me, John Aaron, at johnaaron.net, and Doug at dougsdharma.com.